This episode of Creativity in Captivity is sponsored by the Curtis Theater in Brea, California, presenting Don Reed's The Never Too Late Show on Saturday, May 11th. Tickets are available at the Curtis Theater website. Get ready for insight and inspiration on the creative process from an array of artists, writers, and visionaries on May 9th, when Season 7 of Creativity in Captivity kicks off. In the meantime, please enjoy over 150 episodes hosted by Pat Hazel with a stable of creative guests in our listening lounge at creativityincaptivity.fun.
This is Creativity in Captivity, and I'm Pat Hazel. My guest today has spent over three decades on the boards of Broadway. He is one of only nine actors to win a Tony Award twice for Best Actor in a Broadway Musical. Among his many credits are The Last 5 Years, Wicked, Big Fish, and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. He's a versatile hyphenate with four solo records as a singer-songwriter, and he can be seen regularly on TV and film, ranging from Netflix Bloodline to the most recent Exorcist sequel. Coming up is my conversation with one of Broadway's legendary leading men and a storied song and dance man, Norbert Leo Butz.
That spark of electricity, a skipping stone that sets you free, you're captive to a mystery, the curse of creativity. La 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 la.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks. It's great to be here. My God, that intro. I'm blushing behind my microphone.
That's not the half of it. I had to shorten the credits and say among his, because you really have had an awful lot of work.
Yeah, but let's be honest, Pat. I turned 57. It also means you're old.
It wasn't an obituary I was reading. It could have been worse. In your lifetime, did you imagine all these opportunities unfolding from when you were maybe young in the arts?
Oh, boy. I imagined it would be true. I was a real shy, introverted kid. I lived in my imagination almost all the time. And I hoped that there was a life beyond rural Missouri. I had no idea what that was going to look like. I've had the good fortune, Pat, of having some really great mentors and just being dumb enough to not question the gift horse, to just take the opportunities as they've come and try to build a career in this nutty business. But yeah, it's a long way from my roots to where I'm at.
Well, imagination is one of the key factors. Einstein said that logic will get you from A to B, but imagination will take you everywhere.
What a smart guy.
Well, I think he did all right.
Did okay.
Tell me a little bit about those mentors early on, though. Who made the first big impact on your theatrical adventure?
I'm the seventh of 11 kids. Take a wild guess. I'm Catholic? Yes, I'm Catholic. No longer practicing, but was raised by devoutly Catholic and religious parents. So when you grew up in a family that big, especially if you're in that middle group, it was really my older brothers that I emulated. My oldest brother was a huge influence on my life. Great musician. He was a great guitar player, music fan. He's 10 years older than me. Did the plays in high school. The next brother under him was a good accordion piano player. My maternal grandfather could play anything he picked up and had an amazing voice. So it came within my family. And we were raised in the church, Pat. So that's where I learned to sing. That's where I learned to harmonize. And funnily enough, I think that's where I got the theater bug. Church is ritualistic, especially in the Catholicism that I was raised in. It's a kind of a theater. And I was obsessed with it. With the pomp, with the liturgy, with the ritualistic storytelling. So I would say those are my earliest influences. And then I got lucky. I always tell people I had to be told that I had talent. I was a super shy, really introverted kid. Let me just remind your listeners, my name is Norbert. I mean, when you grow up with that kind of albatross around your neck, Norbert Leo Butz, named after both my grandfathers. Here's what an outsider I felt like, Pat. I have seven brothers. Their names are Steve, Mike, John, Tom, Tony, Tim, and Jim. Norbert, right? I always say it lands like a fart at a funeral.
It sounds like they ran out of Catholic names.
Well, the story is that my mom should get knocked up again every year. And every year my father would say, my dad's name is Norbert. Can we please name this one Norbert? She was like, hell no, I'm not naming a baby Norbert. I was born in 1967, and in St. Louis, Missouri, that was the first year that men could be in the delivery room. Before then, men could not be a part of their wives' labor. That was strictly separate. That's when you stood in the waiting rooms and smoked cigars. I am the only one of the 11 of us that my dad actually helped to deliver. And he was so moved by the experience, even though I was his seventh offspring. He begged, "Can this one be Norbert?" My mother was still like, "Hell no." But my mom was had some complications after my delivery, and my dad changed the birth certificate. My name was Timothy James for a day, and he went in and changed it.
Right. You've been playing this character, Norbert, all your life now.
No, that was my name was changed after I was, I don't know, a few hours old. And then 3 months after my birth, my mom got knocked up again, and I have a brother 14 months younger named Tim. So someone else got that name. I was not a performative kid. I wasn't the one mucking it up in front of the cameras or look at me. I hid. My mom says she has no recollection of me speaking before the age of 13.
But I would think among 11 kids, plenty of people were talking. So you plenty. Were maybe in an observation mode.
100%. And my dad, God bless him, he's gone now, was a super volatile dude. He could be a scary, scary dude. He mellowed in his old age, but he was from extreme poverty and a lot of addiction and joined the Marines at 18. And that was his ethos. That's how he ruled. You ever see The Great Santini? So I had this real internal life. And then it was a choir teacher, I think, at first who just made me sing. I didn't want to join. He made me join. He heard me sing somewhere in the background and said, "Come up closer to the mic." I got into high school. I didn't want to sing. We had like a select choir in high school. A couple of my brothers were in it. She was like, "I know that little one can sing." So she brought me in, made me do some scales. She said, "Oh, okay. Not only can you sing, I want your parents to start sending you to private voice lessons. And I want you to audition for the musical." And then I got the role in the musical. And then that director from my high school said, "You know what? I was going to be a journalism major or a music major." That theater teacher said, "You've got something. Go study acting. There's a Conservatory of Theater Arts in St. Louis, Missouri at Webster University. Audition there. Help me do the applications." And I lied to my parents. I didn't even tell them I was auditioning there. My dad's first generation immigrant as well, German immigrant. And the idea that you would go into an acting program, a theater degree, was just unconscionable to him. So I had to be urged and pushed and sort of told the gifts that I had. And I was just fortunate enough to follow those voices. My parents eventually totally came around and became huge fans, super proud parents. But it was a long, long struggle. So I have to give credit where credit is due.
No, it sounds like a lot of people helped you navigate that and guided you a little bit.
Well, let me just say, not just that, too. With 11 kids, my dad sold insurance door to door. There was no money. So I was given a financial leg up. There was a lot of conversation around white privilege, and we were a working class family. When I was a kid, working poor, my dad eventually had a real career turnabout when I was in my elementary school years. We were given help. There were scholarship, there was work study, there was tuition, that scholarship money that I applied for and got. So it was that kind of help that I got as well along the way. That was a big part of it.
Many people don't get to pursue their talent, whatever it is. If you're a great horseback rider, you got to have a horse. There are obstacles along the way. But I would think that music, because it was happening in your household, there was a DNA there with your brothers. It came as an outlet to express yourself without realizing you were developing the talent along the way.
100%. And remains that way for me today, Pat. Music has always been the thing that has righted my ship, as it were. It calms me down. It gives me a place to put my energy and ambition. It helps me to console myself. I had a raw ability. What I didn't have was access to the educational institutions to help hone it, to help shape it, give me some technique. That was where I really did need the help. I did a BFA. And then from there, was lucky enough to get an MFA at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival, which is in Montgomery, Alabama. Did my BFA at Webster. An actor that I met there at the Repertory Theater of St. Louis said, "Hey, if you want to concentrate more on the classics," which I had really fallen in love with Shakespeare in my early 20s, "come down to Alabama Shakespeare Festival. It's a 2-year MFA program, full tuition waiver. It was adjudicated through University of Alabama, but we were on site of a professional theater for the entire 2 years of the degree. It was a free MFA, basically, for me. And they gave us a stipend to do. I did some adjunct teaching at Auburn while I was there. So these opportunities to help take what I had and build a career out of it.
And how did that study of Shakespeare and working at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival inform your work that's not Shakespearean?
My philosophy is that Shakespeare is the summit. If you can do that, if you can analyze that text, if you can speak and act on the line and psychologically make sense of that text, you can do anything. If a violin player can play Handel or Mozart, they're going to be okay doing bluegrass, you know? If a singer can sing Bellini or Schumann or any of those art song composers, they're going to be able to sing a Broadway tune.
You mentioned earlier at church that you saw that as storytelling. And isn't that really the core of all the performance in Broadway and in television and film, that you're a storyteller among many storytellers putting this story out in the world?
I agree with that statement. Yes, we are storytellers. But your responsibility to the story is as the interpreter of the music or the interpreter of the text. That's my specific way to help tell the story. I'm a linebacker in an otherwise offensive storytellers. So to do it to the best of my ability, I really felt like I needed the technique. Because what I would do again, Pat, I was obsessed with film early on. And then I became obsessed with theater. I did a year and a half in London as an undergrad and saw all the greats. I saw Vanessa Redgrave on stage. I saw Michael Gambon on stage. I saw Anthony Hopkins on stage, right? What are they doing? You become totally captured by a performance or by the power that an actor has. So you dig into them. You read the bios. You look at their credits. And they've got Shakespeare all over their credits. So I think even in my 21-year-old mind, I'm like, okay, follow that arrow. They're able to have such intelligence and such emotional openness at the same time. Storytelling's not just emotion. It's also not just being in your head and analytical. It's all of it. And it's ineffable. It's difficult to put into language, but you know it when it happens. You always know it when you're feeling it. And so I think I was just trying to follow the people that were really moving me.
But you're also a very dynamic and engaging performer. I know in the original Broadway production of Stephen Schwartz's Wicked, you sang the song Dancing Through Life, which is not necessarily the number one song of the show, but you get to be the originator of that tune in that performance. So there's a lyric in that that says, learn to live the unexamined life. And you're now telling the audience a part of the story, but also music has such a powerful emotional moment that you can learn and retain things.
None of us do this in a bubble. That score was written by Stephen Schwartz, incredibly prolific, brilliant composer. And there was another number in the original version of Wicked in place of that song. That song was the third song he wrote for me to try to make pop in that moment. In the original San Francisco, I sang a different song called Which Way's the Party? And it wasn't working. That ineffable thing. Audience was tuning out. The character wasn't popping enough. The lyrics weren't interesting enough. Before we came to New York, Stephen had me over to his apartment. I'm talking about the collaborative nature now of how to get to what you're talking about. Stephen says, I've got three different options here. Take a listen. He played me one that had a kind of a Johnny B. Goode type old time sort of 50s rock feel to it. Another one had a disco vibe. And then he said, but check this one out. And he'd been listening a lot to Sting and the Police. So he started playing me the basic idea of Dancing Through Life. It actually has a reggae. It's got a ska beat when it gets into the chorus. And that's what gives it such a pop. And I said, oh, I'm a huge Police fan. Stephen Schwartz and I both landed on the Police as a common ground of fandom. And I started singing along with it, adding a few notes. Stephen threw out some lyrics. I'm not saying I wrote it. That is Steven's song, but it was written so specifically for what I could do, how it sat in my voice. Sting is a big influence on the way I sing. And so you just put all that together in the kind of soup, and then it comes out with a number like that. And I hear people love that song. People all the time come up to me and sing that song to me. But it was born out of a lot of failure.
Broadway musical is the longest, slowest turning ship in the ocean.
It's a miracle that any of them ever open.
Even the most talented among composers, there are years of workshopping things and running them. And then to find out one little thing is not allowing that story to go, or that opening number is keeping the audience from engaging. Like, that is a tricky, a safe to crack in terms of every tumbler falling into place.
I'll be honest with you. I've had a long journey with musicals. I grew up loving the movie musical. I was obsessed with James Cagney as a kid. I saw Yankee Doodle Dandy when I was about 8 years old. And eventually I recorded it on VHS tape. I watched it all the time. That dude was my North Star, Jimmy Cagney. I was like, the quirky dancing, the acting chops, the kind of danger and menace he brought, even to light musical fare. I loved West Side Story. And then when I got into high school and college, I really wanted to be an actor. And I was just like super turned off by musicals. I was like, ugh, I just couldn't get behind them. That was the Les Mis era and all the big bombastic show and Phantom. The music was over the top and none of it made any psychological sense to me. And it was all big, emotional, pandering type of vibes. And I did not do a professional musical. I did a couple musicals in high school and spent all my 20s just as an actor. I did not want to do musicals. My first professional musical was Rent on Broadway.
Oh, right. Well, this is where you made your Broadway debut as a replacement. A replacement swing, which...
Yeah, I covered the two lead guys whenever they would be out. I played the role of Roger every Sunday night. Yeah, I was a relief pitcher. And then I took over the role full-time in the second year of the run. But then I had a real change of heart. Once I was thrown into the majors, I was planning a totally different career. But I've since really changed my tune on musicals. I've loved doing them, and I've loved the process of it because of what we're talking about, because it is so hard. It's like Shakespeare. You know how you go see a Shakespeare play, and 9 times out of 10, they suck? Because they're that hard to do. Only a very select few people can operate at that Olympian level. And Broadway musical actors are the Olympians of Broadway. I mean, that's how hard this stuff is to do. And that's how hard it is to develop it. That's how hard there's nothing organic about a musical. And it's a totally American art form, like up there with country music and jazz. Totally American. It should not work on paper. What? There's right. Dancing, there's singing, there's acting, there's all this stuff coming together. Well, how does this work? But here's what I love about it, Pat, is that it's holistic. I'm a restless person and I have these different skills. Only in musicals do I get to use my full body. I love to dance. I'm a musician. I'm a trained actor. I want to do it all. I want a holistic experience. I want to be exhausted when I hit that curtain call every night in a way that a lot of times you just aren't when you're doing a play. You're really not when you're doing a role in a film, unless you're number one on the call sheet. There's a feeling of being spent afterwards of, wow, I've just used everything I can possibly do. And that is an addictive feeling. That's why I've loved doing them.
Well, I first saw you on the tour playing the MC in Cabaret in California, and that's a demanding role. Talk about leaving it all on the boards.
Absolutely. I don't know why I've always been drawn to the hard stuff, but that role was right up there, an incredibly difficult part that I don't think I was very good in for the first couple of months of that tour.
I must have seen you after the first couple of months.
I grew into the part. The brilliant Rob Marshall, Sam Mendes directed that, and it was a hyper-physical production. It was a very political production, very smart production, very dark. And the role of the MC, here's what I found challenging about that part. If you know Cabaret, you've seen Joel Grey and the brilliant Joel Grey. I succeeded the brilliant, equally brilliant Alan Cumming, who did it on Broadway. I was the first actor to do it after those two guys. This is a role with very little text. I'm a text person. I've been classically trained. it's told through song. The whole character is told through these musical set pieces that he does throughout the show. And it was so difficult to get a whole character who's ultimately an enigma. Ultimately, a political idea is the character. He's a philosophical kind of clown. I was only 30 when I played it. I think I just didn't maybe have enough behind me. And the cojones to get out there, like Alan Cumming had, to just say, no, you're going to look at me. You're going to look at me and only me all night. And just the glee with that. I found myself very exposed, but I learned so much in that production. And in my opinion, Cabaret, number for number, scene for scene, the best written book of a musical ever, period, out there. It still packs a huge punch and is even coming back to Broadway in a couple of months in yet another revival.
Well, doing revivals, the audience comes to certain things with an expectation. They've seen a movie or they've seen the previous production. And that must be at least daunting until you get it under your belt and start owning it. And even with the interpretation from a new director or a new outlook of how it's going to be approached, is quite a bit different than originating a role, which you've done quite a few times on Broadway. When you do originate a role, how much challenge or how much fun comes with the development of a brand new character and storyline that maybe later other people are going to imitate?
There's nothing quite as fulfilling, frankly, addictively thrilling, as being the first person to create a part and then have that live on. My entire career was that for the first 20 years. I only wanted to do original work, new plays. I was not a revival guy. I was like, there's enough guys to do Cabaret or Sweeney Todd. I want to do the parts that have yet to be. After 20 years of that, I really changed my tune on this subject. We were talking before about the development of the musical, the years that are put into it. I think the last original musical I did on Broadway was Big Fish. And these shows take years of your life. They take all of you. They take your mental health. They take your physical health.
No, I had the pleasure of seeing Big Fish. That was an Andrew Lippa musical that was directed by Susan Stroman. The setting and the color and the gimmicks, and it was really, really a spectacular production. And it was too bad that it didn't live longer, which is also the roll of the dice with Broadway. I remember the fish jumping out of the pit up to the cast, trying to catch all these fish, this beautiful field of flowers. Some of the songs really stood out to me. Be the Hero is an anthem for anybody that wants to dream or become something. It's definitely one I would encourage folks to look up on Spotify with your interpretation of that particular song.
Oh, thank you. We both know Susan Stroman, and her particular genius is creating these amazing visual metaphors on stage that are just stunning. She's one of those directors that can just create an image on stage, largely through dance and movement, that just stops your heart. When you're developing the show to be crass, you're not making any money. That's all pro bono work. You get paid maybe stipends or bus fare or whatever, but you're not making any money. Really, you don't make any money until everybody else makes money. Until it's a hit, do you make money? So when you're originating a role, you're going on a wing and a prayer and just a ton of sweat equity. And then after the years of work, you open on Broadway, the reviews are not good, and you're done in 3 months. So that salary that you got on Broadway for 3 months has got to be then divided over the 5 years of work you put into it. And I was doing all these new work, and I was broke. I've got three kids. I had two Tony Awards, and I was broke. I couldn't make any money. The adage in my business is you can make a killing on Broadway, but you cannot make a living. And that is absolutely the truth of what the economics of Broadway look like. Big Fish is a perfect example of where the economics of Broadway started to not work for me anymore. That show was so expensive. We would have needed to sell out that theater, which was 1,100, 1,200 seats, every single night without a discounted ticket for 5 straight years in order to turn a profit. That happens once every 15 to 20 years. That's your Hamilton. That's your Wicked. That's your Rent, right?
But the audience doesn't know that. The audience is not aware of the economics. In fact, a thing like Off-Broadway, 20 years ago, I was enamored by Off-Broadway because of the originality and all that. There is absolutely no way for that model to work for the number of seats. You can't pay enough. You can't stay enough. You can't afford the advertising. You immediately are competing with discounted tickets in the middle of Times Square. It's a losing battle for storytelling.
It really is. After Big Fish was financially a disaster for me, I have three daughters. I had two in college at the time. I've got one still to get through college. I was like, I got to find another model for me here. And so I began turning down a lot of offers to develop new work. And I've been working mostly in film and television since then. The one major commitment that I gave was for a very well-known property called My Fair Lady. It's the last time I was on Broadway. And I had such a joy on that show. I said before, I didn't want to do revivals. Now I only want to do revivals. What's that Mark Twain joke? I'll work with the writer, but only if the writer is dead and has been dead for 50 years.
Right. I understand. So that was 2018. You did the Broadway revival of My Fair Lady and you played the part of Alfred Doolittle. So you're coming to a brand that people already love.
You call it a brand, I suppose, in an economic sense, but artistically, you are coming to a script and a score that is so architecturally solid. You're coming as an actor to a piece of writing that is perfect. It's perfect. I said before, Cabaret was my favorite. For the record, I'll scratch that and say My Fair Lady is actually the best book of a musical because it's actually straight from the Shaw. With so much of the new stuff, like I said, you're in that process of constantly rewriting it, trying numbers, having those numbers cut, trying new numbers. That show works. It's up to the director and the actors to screw it up. But as a text, that's your blueprint. You're golden. And that's an amazing part I got to play in that show. I mean, what a great, great role. And had a ball doing it. And it just worked better for where I'm at now. My youngest is 13. And the new work means you go out of town for 6 months. You come back, you workshop it. You go out of town again for another 6 months. You do a pre-Broadway tour. You know, you got to put in these years of work. And maybe there will be another original musical down the road for me somewhere.
You're saying people have to tell you have talent. Well, at this point, many, many people know that you have talent. But it is important for them to know that when you're raising a family, when your other responsibilities include husband and dad and things other than that, it does have to make sense for you to invest your time. The budget of the amount of time that the audience does not see to the time on stage where you look like you're having a good time. And I don't mean that rehearsal is arduous. It's just required. You can't just dive into a show. There have been times probably you had to step in to take over a production where you have very little study time. It's great that you have a toolkit that allows you to memorize and be able to step into that as you did maybe as a swing in Rent.
Well, I stepped into David Mamet's Speed the Plow in 48 hours.
That's right, replacing Jeremy Piven, who already had quite a bit of visibility.
You're 100% right. And again, thinking back on that young actor, I'm so grateful for the time I invested in my education, because without that, I honestly don't know how I would have been able to take advantage of these opportunities that have come my way. Something I've loved doing, Pat, is creating my own cabaret shows, my own one-man music pieces. And I've done a few of them now for 54 Below. They give me so much birth there to play with what I want to do with my original stuff and curating sets of songs. In 2015, I did this show. I called it Girls, Girls, Girls. And I started with the premise that I've got three daughters. I have 17 nieces. I've got a wife. I have an ex-wife. I have three sisters. I'm often the only male in a room. And I was constantly being told, you don't understand how we think. You don't understand us. And so I kind of take that as a comical takeoff point to delve into the mind of the female. And I use Jungian archetypes and Greek goddesses as sort of archetypes. And then I find a modern pop, rock, or musical theater song that kind of illuminates each of those goddesses. And I take them on this journey. I had a friend who called it like a straight guy's tutorial on what it means to be a feminist in this crazy age. And I hired a great rock band, and it was a super fun show. But yeah, it was directly inspired by being a girl dad, yeah, for sure.
And isn't there a lot of joy in that kind of presenting of material, in that you get to be Norbert not another character. You get to be the storyteller and the singer, and you interpret the song the way you want. Ultimately, it's the ultimate showcase of how you express yourself.
Absolutely. And again, this whole conversation started with me saying I had to be told that I was talented enough to do something. Richard Frankel came to me right when he opened 54 Below, said, I want you to do a week of your own thing here. I said, Richard, I don't do cabaret. I was in rock bands in high school and college, and now I have this musical theater career. I'm not a Patti LuPone. I'm not a Christine Ebersole. I'm not somebody who can stand at a mic in a beautiful outfit with a piano player and do Sondheim covers. You know, it's just not me. I said I'd never seen a Broadway musical until I was in one. I'd never been to a cabaret. I'd never been to the Carlisle. I thought this was an elite world that had nothing to do with me. And he said, Norbert, you're selling yourself short. Come. It's 2016. This whole world has opened up. Do what you want. He lit a fire under my ass. And I said, okay. I hired a music director and I started coming up with some tunes that I really wanted to sing. I've always just wanted to sing. And a theme emerged. And the first show I did there, I called it Memory and Mayhem. And all of the songs were memory songs, somebody looking back. I found a theme that kind of united it. And I loved it. And I found through that first week's run, I found this whole other way to express myself. And I didn't have to wait for someone else to say yes to me.
That's the big difference, right?
It's a huge difference. We actors, we sit around begging for permission to do the thing that we're excellent at. Please let me do the thing that I'm super skilled at doing. Please, please, please. And that just started flipping for me somewhere in my 40s, where I was just like, I no longer ask permission.
The difference in my eyes is that it's like The Bachelor, where you're waiting to get picked and you're waiting to be given the rose. And it's quite a bit different when you're proactive about just going out and showing your power and seeing what it attracts to you. So that proactivity is quite a bit different than the desire, I want to get this part. If they just gave it to me, I could show them. And there's only one of those golden tickets on those shows. And okay, so now you don't get to be the lead, so you got to be in on the ensemble. And every step of doing that, even being the ensemble, you're trying to prove that you're good enough to be a lead in a future show.
Right.
But
exactly.
You were able then to record some of these.
We recorded it over a couple nights and mixed it, and they released it. And I'm thrilled with it. And I've done two other records for them there.
Right. So I want to be able to encourage the listener that they can find on Spotify some of these live from 54 Below, including Memory and Mayhem, which you just mentioned. I clicked on If These Walls Could Speak, which was a Jimmy Webb tune, and it was awesome. It was really a really beautiful interpretation and has nearly 200,000 downloads at this point.
I'm not a huge social media guy. I try to stay somewhat connected to... Here's the thing I found, Pat, when social media exploded. I'm not a very social person, and I hate the media. I'm doubly screwed. But I do try to stay active on Instagram just to let people know where they can find me. So they can go to my Instagram.
Well, maybe we can call you the king of anti-social media.
Well, I'm not a total Luddite. I have friends who are like, can't even turn the thing on. It's not my natural go-to, for sure.
You have such a great range in what you do. And when you play a role like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which had been a movie but had not been a musical, right?
Correct. It had been two movies. It was a movie first. Marlon Brando and David Niven did a movie called Bedtime Story, one of Brando's only comedic performances on film. And I think he's great in it. And then again, obviously with Steve Martin and Michael Caine.
But now you get to bring it to the musical, but you still get all the fun of playing the character. Obviously, one of the Tony Awards came for that performance, and the audience and the Tony voters can see all the nuance of that performance. It's, I imagine, a pretty spectacular thing to be recognized by your peer group.
Oh, it was a night I'll never forget. My parents were both still alive and were there at the ceremony with me. We started this conversation talking about how scared they were for me of dedicating myself to a life in the arts. And I was able to thank them from...
That's when they found out you were an actor?
That's when I think my dad took a breath and said, okay, I think he's going to be okay.
I love the miniseries, Fosse Verdon.
That was an absolute joy. Really, really a joy. Directed by Tommy Cale, not long after his Hamilton coup. Brilliant director. And I got to work again with my buddy Sam Rockwell. Sam and I had done an indie film together years ago called Lessons in Chemistry. So to get to play buddies on that. And I'm at the age now where the most joy I get out of the work, Pat, and I know you feel the same way, it's the research. Getting to do a deep dive into Sam Wesson's book, Fosse, that brilliant, brilliant, huge novel, into New York City in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and that coterie of great, great theater makers that was around then, this group of friends, including Neil Simon, Bob Fosse, Patty Chayefsky, Gwen Verdon, these witty, fabulous, tortured as well people, was just a joy.
Well, in that study of playing a real person, because you've done it with Jeffrey Skilling in the Enron piece and other folks like that, tell me about the study and the responsibility of trying to ostensibly be that real person versus these fantastical characters that are made up.
Chayefsky's fascinating because he remains a kind of a footnote in pop culture. First of all, he was a writer, a sometime director, but a writer, a playwright, and a two-time Academy Award-winning screenwriter. And this is before YouTube. This is the 50s and 60s. There's not a ton of footage of him, so I didn't feel constrained or beholden to holding up some image of Patty Chayefsky. Nobody would have known what he sounded or looked like. Obviously, there is footage that I was able to see. I talked a lot with Bob Fosse's daughter, who was a consultant on the film. I got some personal recordings from him. I got to do a deep dive into him, but I also had a wide berth. I'm doing a project right now, which I can't really talk about, but a very, very famous sports figure. And that one is much more challenging because this guy's really had a lot of media attention.
Is he still alive? I know you can't tell us any details, but are you playing somebody that can see your performance?
Yes. And I've done that a couple of times. I did a very tragic, dark miniseries called Girl from Plainview for Hulu about the terrible case in Massachusetts of a kid who killed himself at the behest of his girlfriend. And then the girlfriend was charged for manslaughter for those text messages. And I played the grieving father of this kid. And that guy's still alive. And that was a really, really painful job. Your empathy is just so far out there and you just want to get it right. But Chayefsky was fantastic because I could have my version of him and who was going to argue with it? Nobody. People don't even know when they're seeing a Chayefsky film. The brilliant Network he wrote, still one of the greatest satires ever written. Another film that most people don't know, his first Oscar nomination, I think he was nominated four times. His first Oscar nomination was for a film called The Hospital with George C. Scott and Diana Rigg, which I always tell people, go find that movie. It's a comical kind of takedown of New York City health industries, of a big hospital and kind of the egos that are on the boards of those big hospitals. And then the beautiful film Marty with Ernest Borgnine. I tell you, Pat, you'd go on set and there was a spooky thing that happened on that set. Those actors were so good. My friend Nate Cordry played Neil Simon and oh my God. It was like you were sitting there with these legends.
You are heavily made up to look like Patty Chayefsky, right?
Yeah, I did the wig and grew a beard and no one will ever recognize me from that part. Acting is a lot of things. I do think it's an intellectual process, but a big part of it at the end of the day is called dress up. Like when we were five, it's pretend. And when you get actors of that caliber who are pretending at that level, I'm telling you, it changes the energy in a room. It's quite magical. I love that.
Okay, so here's your opportunity to give advice to the person that is going to play Norbert Leo Butz in the definitive story of your life. What is it that they need to know internally about you that they can get it right?
Well, when you said advice, my only advice to people is never take anybody's advice. I always took advice from people and it made me a people pleaser for a long time. I always feel like advice is someone you're asking someone to tell you what to do and who you are. And that's an inside job. But if they were trying to get to what makes me tick, I'll refrain from turning this into a joke. And I would try to sincerely and earnestly respond. I'm a person of faith. I was raised in a strict religious household. and turned my back on that so hard by the time I was 16, like most of us do, and spent about 30 years trying to forget the kind of dogma that I was raised into. And I found myself at this ever advancing age, falling back on some of those beliefs. And I would not say it's institutional or even a Western type of spirituality. But I have discovered the importance of having belief, even belief in belief, if that makes a kind of sense. At the end of the day, you know as well as I, this is a super fickle business, and to try to glean any self-esteem or identity strictly from it is a fool's errand. That is a dangerous place to go. And I discovered with the ups and downs of this things that I better lay my claim on something a bit more solid. So I've come back to a kind of a spiritual practice, and that's been working for me as of late.
When writing the story of your life, I don't remember who said this, they said, don't let anyone else hold the pen.
I love that.
That you be the author of your story.
Be the hero of your story.
Yeah. So I think we're going to close this episode out hearing a little bit of the lyric of Be the Hero that you sang in Andrew Lippa's Big Fish.
That would make me very happy.
Hey, I appreciate you investing the time and energy today.
I love talking to you, Pat.
What if I told you you could change the world with just one thought? What if I told you you could be a king? Anything you desire, boy, anything on a plate, all within your power to create. I know somewhere in the darkness there's a story meant for me, where I always know exactly what to say. I know somewhere some surprising ending waits for me to tell it my own way. Be the hero of your story if you can. Be the champion in the fight, not just the man. Don't depend on other people to put paper next to pen. Be the hero of your story, boy, and then you can rise to be the hero once again.
Thanks for listening. Take a moment to subscribe, and we will hold your seat for more creative conversation and a weekly spark of inspiration. Our show is produced by Sweetwood Creative in Austin, Texas, with sound editing and crafty co-producing by Tucker Hazel. The original music theme was created and sung by Maya Sharp, with additional production support and sanity provided by Diane Johansson, Tony Deo, and Tanner Dykstra. Please feel free to dash off a review on social media to help grow this creative community. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, or visit our website at creativityincaptivity.fun. You heard that right, dot fun, as in dot was so fun. Bye for now.
La, 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 la. Staring at an empty page, stepping on a ghostlit stage, a circus of uncertainty. Your call.